Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian Lebeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Frederick Douglass's autobiography, published in 1845, after Douglass escaped from slavery, became an international bestseller, as well as a rallying point for the abolitionist movement in the United States. Our guest this week, William L. Andrews of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, examines Douglass's autobiography as a source of information on both the man and the institution. And after that, Doug Weed joins us to answer the question, why have so many presidents' kids gone wrong? But first, Joey Skidmore takes us back to an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on January 11, 1928, Joseph Stalin banished fellow Russian revolutionary Leon Trotsky to Siberia. Trotsky developed an interest in Marxism while a student at the University of Odessa. He left his studies to organize the South Russian Workers' Union, but was arrested, imprisoned, and exiled to Siberia for the first time in 1900. He escaped to England, where he met and befriended Vladimir Lenin, but he returned to his native land at the outbreak of the Russian Revolution of 1905. When that uprising failed, Trotsky was arrested and exiled to Siberia for the second time. Once again he escaped, this time heading for Switzerland, Spain, Paris, and New York, only to return at the outbreak of the revolution in 1917. Trotsky played a leading role in the Bolshevik seizure of power. Lenin appointed him Secretary of Foreign Affairs and later War Commissioner, where he helped secure the Soviet state by crushing all opposition. But Lenin died in 1924, and Trotsky lost to Stalin in the ensuing power struggle. When the two quarreled over Trotsky's position that it was impossible to build socialism in one country alone, that worldwide revolution was necessary, and that the Soviet Union should lead that revolution, Stalin exiled him. In 1929, Stalin expelled Trotsky from the USSR altogether. He lived in Turkey, France, and Norway, until upon the urging of artist Diego Rivera, Trotsky was granted asylum in Mexico. He took up residence in Mexico City, where on August 20, 1940, during Stalin's purges back home, and some theorize under Stalin's orders, a Spanish communist murdered Trotsky with a blow to the head with an ice axe.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, laser scanning has revealed ancient carvings on the pillars of Stonehenge that are invisible to the naked eye. The experiment scanned just 3 of the 83 stones that make up the famous prehistoric monument, but archaeologists hope that a full survey will help them determine once and for all the purpose of the ancient construction. The newfound carvings are just a few millimeters deep and were made by bronze axe heads some 500 years after Stonehenge was erected, or about 1800 BC. Similar Bronze Age carvings have been found at burial sites all over the UK, leading archaeologists to speculate that at least by 1800 BC, Stonehenge was used to commemorate the dead. This is Talking History. This week, we're pleased to welcome a new contributor to Talking History, the teacher as historian. The Teacher as Historian is produced at WNYE-FM in New York City by Erwin Gonchak in collaboration with WNYE, the Library of America, and the Teachers and Writers Collaborative. And like Talking History, it is dedicated to providing teachers as well as the general public with the latest and best historical scholarship. In this program, William L. Andrews, Professor of History at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, examines the narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass, an American slave, written by an escaped slave and published in 1845. Andrews tells us what we can learn from it about slavery and the man who went on to become a national leader and advisor to American presidents and the holder of several high federal offices.
I was born in Tuckahoe, near Hillsboro, and about 12 miles from Easton, in Talbot County, Maryland. I have no accurate knowledge of my age, never having seen any authentic record containing it. By far the larger part of the slaves, know as little of their ages as horses know of theirs, and it is the wish of most masters within my knowledge to keep their slaves thus ignorant. I do not remember to have ever met a slave who could tell of his birthday. They seldom come nearer to it than planting time, harvest time, cherry time, spring time, or fall time. A want of information concerning my own was a source of unhappiness to me even during childhood. The white children could tell their ages. I could not tell why I ought to be deprived of the same privilege. I was not allowed to make any inquiries of my master concerning it. He deemed all such inquiries on the part of a slave improper and impertinent, and evidence of a restless spirit. This is the opening paragraph of Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, an American Slave, published in Boston in 1845. This is William L. Andrews, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, here to talk about Frederick Douglass's classic American autobiography and his memorable contribution to the slave narrative tradition. Frederick Douglass's narrative was an international bestseller, making its author the most famous African-American of his era. More people read this former slave's autobiography in the first 5 years of its existence than read Melville's Moby Dick, Thoreau's Walden, and Whitman's Leaves of Grass combined during a comparable period of time. In the 1840s and 1850s, Douglass was one of the most celebrated orators on the American scene. Because the publication of his narrative made it easy for his former master to find him and take him back to slavery, Douglass journeyed to England in 1845, where his anti-slavery lecture tour won him many supporters. Returning to America in 1847, Douglass, who had never had a day of schooling in his life, became the editor of his own newspaper, the North Star, which he published every week for 16 years. In 1848, Douglass was the only prominent man, white or black, to attend the Seneca Falls, New York, National Meeting on Women's Rights, which launched the feminist movement in America. During the Civil War, Douglass was one of the advisors to President Lincoln, who convinced him to allow African Americans to enlist in the U.S. Army and Navy, which helped turn the tide of the conflict in favor of the North. After the end of the war, Douglass pleaded with President Andrew Johnson for a National Voting Rights Act that would allow blacks to vote in all the states. In the last 30 years of his life, the one-time slave attained the highest political offices that any black man from the North had ever won: federal marshal and recorder of deeds for the District of Columbia, president of the Freedmen's Bureau Bank, consul to Haiti in charge d'affaires for the Dominican Republic. In the last 20 years, Douglass has come into his own not only as a major historical figure, but also as an outstanding literary figure in the mid-19th century. Douglass was not the first former slave to write the story of his life in slavery. In the English-speaking world, the slave narrative was more than 50 years old before Douglass contributed to it. Few would disagree, however, that Douglass's is the most accomplished of the 100 slave narratives that were published before 1865. Three key subjects dominate the agenda of almost all slave narratives. These subjects are, first, the nature of slavery; second, the individual selfhood of the narrator; and third, the narrator's mastery of the arts of language. I will discuss each of these topics, highlighting the ways that Douglass handled each one. First, the nature of slavery. What was this institution really like? Douglass's readers knew it was a fundamentally economic institution. It was the cornerstone of the economy of half the United States. There was a huge capital investment in slavery, and a tremendous effort made constantly to justify slavery, not only as an economic necessity, but as a biblically sanctioned, benevolent institution. It was the aim of the slave narrative to debunk popular myths about slavery. The idea was to let the slave, who knew slavery better than anyone else, tell the true story of slavery, provide the reader with the real facts of the matter. Second, the individual selfhood of the slave narrator. Every autobiography is written about a self, myself. The standard purpose of an autobiography is to identify its author and to explain who he or she is as a special individual, a person whose life is important enough, whose ideas and beliefs are distinctive enough to merit being published in a book. Autobiography is the most egocentric form of writing there is. However, in 19th century America, at the time Douglas wrote his autobiography, there was much debate over whether blacks were really people at all. According to the Constitution of the United States, the millions of slaves living in the South were not considered people. They were classed as chattel, property. They had no more right to their own persons than a horse or a table. The justifiers of slavery, and there were hundreds of articles, books, sermons, and speeches delivered on this topic every year, argued that black people were not fully human. They were supposedly a separate species that looked and behaved in some ways like whites, but that weren't capable of the same attainments as whites. The aim of the slave narrative, and no one did this better than Douglas, was to demonstrate the selfhood of the former slave, and to prove that he is fully human, fully developed, fully an adult self. This, however, was no easy task. Why? How do you write an autobiography about yourself when your reader has real doubts about whether you have a self at all? And if your reader thinks you aren't fully human, how do you write about yourself to prove that you are? This is what the slave narrators like Douglass's were determined to prove, nevertheless. They were challenged to find ways to prove their identity as part of the human race, as deserving human rights, and as demanding respect and sympathy from every decent white American. The third key subject of the slave narrative is the importance of literacy, the black mastery of the art of language. In the culture of Western Europe and America, ever since the so-called Enlightenment, the ability to read and write was considered an earmark of civilization. Societies that did not have a written language, in other words, societies based on oral culture, were regarded as uncivilized, savage, even barbarous. With regard to individuals, one of the principal ways a person qualified for respect and status in 19th century society was through the ability to read and write. Think about what it means to be able to write your own name. Your autograph is nothing less than a linguistic demonstration of your uniqueness, your own individual existence, your possession of a self. Thus, for a former slave like Douglass, it was crucial not just to tell a story in which he debunked the myth of slavery and proved to the world his selfhood. It was crucial that he do this in a narrative that he wrote himself. Douglass didn't want any critics saying, "Oh, it's an interesting story, but Douglass didn't write it." That proves that blacks aren't fully capable, aren't fully equal, because they can't handle the written word. Douglass's author aims to prove that he is fully equipped, intellectually and psychologically, to write his own autobiography. Thus, the writing of his narrative is not only a literary act, but a political statement, too.
You're listening to Talking History, and William L. Andrews, professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, discussing the autobiography of Frederick Douglass.
Let's go back now to the three themes of the slave narrative and see how Douglass handles them. First, the theme of slavery as an institution. Although Douglass devotes plenty of space in his narrative to the physical cruelty of slavery, when he talks about himself, he doesn't stress personal cruelty inflicted on him. As far as his growing up was concerned, Douglass shows that slavery was not so much actively cruel as systematized denial and deprivation. This theme emerges from the opening paragraph of the narrative, in which Douglass stresses that he was denied even the knowledge of his own birthday by the slave owner. This point from the outset of his story is intended to make the reader understand that the slave's greatest deprivation is knowledge of himself, After all, if you can't say when you were born or who your father was, your status as an individual in society is very much compromised. Think of what you cannot do in our society without a birthday, without a definable place and record of your birth. Douglass's master strongly opposed the slave boy's efforts to find out how old he was, because he knew that such inquiries were evidence of a restless spirit. Slavery was designed to keep the slave ignorant, because the more the slave becomes self-conscious, the more trouble he is likely to be. Hence, Douglass suggests that from the beginning of his life he was engaged in resistance to slavery, simply by virtue of his natural human desire to know who he is. This leads us into consideration of the second theme of the slave narrative, the theme of the selfhood of the slave. Even as a child, Douglass suggests he was unusual among slaves in asking a lot of questions, particularly about his own origins, and in wondering why whites get answers to those questions and blacks don't. Douglass then structures his entire narrative so that we see his self-awareness growing as he engages in a psychological and intellectual quest for answers about himself and about his destiny. As I point to at least some of the most important turning points in his development, you will see how much his growing up is tied in with his developing sense of the interconnectedness of selfhood and literacy. The first key stage in young Frederick's developing sense of selfhood occurs when he is sent from his birthplace on Maryland's eastern shore to the Baltimore home of Hugh and Sophia Auld. There he meets Sophia, a white woman who initially treats him almost as affectionately as her own son. She helps him learn to read and write until her husband opposes it. Instead of feeling defeated by Auld's opposition, however, young Fred is actually emboldened to pursue his goal of learning to read. Auld reveals to Fred the secret of the slaveholder's power over the slave. It is the power of knowledge over ignorance. But through reading, the slave child can expand his mind and develop an awareness of who he is in the larger scheme of things. It's important to recognize that persisting in this goal of learning to read represents the first time that Douglass consciously disobeyed his master. By the time he was 12 years old, Douglass has come to define his value system as the opposite of whatever the white master values. In Chapter 7, we see how Douglass achieved his goal of learning to read and write, and how miserable such knowledge made him. Knowledge made the slave youth even more aware of how little use that he, a slave, can make of all this expanded awareness. In fact, the more he becomes aware of himself, the more his slave status embitters him against all the whites who try to exert some power over him. From this point on in the narrative, Douglass's desire for mental and psychological liberation can be fulfilled only through physical liberation from slavery. Once Frederick is sent to Edward Covey to have the black youth's resistant spirit broken, the issue becomes how to act on the sense of selfhood that Fred has come to believe in. Covey's techniques are simply to work refractory slaves until they are so exhausted that they cannot resist him. Sure enough, Douglass says, after 6 months of Covey's regime, he too was, quote, broken in body, soul, and spirit, unquote. But Douglass does not make clear what caused him finally to fight back against Covey. But it is less important to us to speculate on why he decided to fight back than it is to recognize the significance of this act for Douglass's growing up. It is a violent act, but not an aggressive act. Douglass stresses that his aim was not so much to beat Covey as to prevent Covey from beating him. Thus, Douglass justifies violence while implying that he engaged in it only as a last resort in defending his human rights as a self. Knowing that many whites would be intimidated by a black slave rebel, Douglass shows how he had no choice but to become a rebel or be brutalized. Thus, slavery is to blame for the violence, not the slave. Violence is not a destructive act. Violence, in this case, is a self-affirming act. In the fight with Covey, Douglas begins to define and exercise what he calls his manhood. He shows that he is a man both because he will fight back against a tyrant and because he knows how to manage violence. Rather than doing physical harm to Covey, Douglas simply overmatches him, proving himself the better man in this battle. To save his reputation, Covey decides not to broadcast the outcome of the battle throughout the neighborhood. Thus, Douglas succeeds in defeating Covey without so humiliating the white man that he must turn to other authorities to discipline the teenage slave. At the same time that Douglas celebrates his defeat of Covey, Douglas also shows his growing sense of community with his fellow slaves. When he makes his first attempt to escape, he plots with several other fellow slaves to make an escape together. This is a sign that Douglas's evolving heroic individualism is not just self-affirming, it also has a liberating function in his community. In the third major phase of Douglas's development, he arrives in the North, having successfully escaped from slavery. He must decide what to do with his new freedom. The last chapter of the narrative reaffirms that Douglas's sense of manhood is not destructive of community, but rather enhances it. First, we see Douglas marrying, becoming a family man. Then he discusses his working life in New Bedford. He starts out at the bottom as a common laborer, but he works hard and makes a name for himself to the point that, by the end of his story, we see him launching a career as a professional lecturer in the anti-slavery movement. Thus, Douglas portrays himself in accordance with the great American dream, the poor, disadvantaged youth who works hard, dedicates himself to a goal, and succeeds. Douglas's goal was freedom and independence, not just for himself, but for all those he left behind in his ascent from bondage in the South to leadership in the North. In the conclusion of his story, Douglas pictures the high point of his life as the day he became a speaker for the abolitionist cause. To Douglas, the power to speak, to use language to change the minds of others, is the greatest power that an individual can exert in a free society. All his life, Douglas has been moving in that direction. He has sought many kinds of power. The power of knowledge to free his mind from ignorance. The power of the body to resist the beatings of Covey. The power of the money he earns to help him flee slavery and become a self-supporting worker in freedom. But the ultimate power for Douglas is the power of self-expression, to speak freely what is on his mind and heart. He had been trained as a slave to doubt himself, particularly when addressing whites. But as he says on the last page of his narrative, when he gave his first anti-slavery speech, quote, "I felt a degree of freedom," unquote, and spoke what was on his mind with conviction. In that moment, Douglas sees the ultimate freedom that his life had been pointing toward, the freedom to identify himself as a man, an individual, with a message for all people to hear. Thus the slave became a master, we might say, a master of himself and of the arts of language. While attending an anti-slavery convention at Nantucket on the 11th of August, 1841, I felt strongly moved to speak, and was at the same time much urged to do so by Mr. William C. Coffin, a gentleman who had heard me speak in the colored people's meeting at New Bedford. It was a severe cross, and I took it up reluctantly. The truth was, I felt myself a slave, and the idea of speaking to white people weighed me down. I spoke but a few moments when I felt a degree of freedom and said what I desired with considerable ease. From that time until now, I have been engaged in pleading the cause of my brethren.
You've been listening to William L. Andrews, Professor of History at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, discussing the autobiography of Frederick Douglass. Andrews' talk has been provided by The Teacher as Historian, a radio program produced at WNYE-FM in New York City by Irwin Gonchek. And this is Talking History. Finally, we turn to our commentary of the week. In 1988, Doug Weed, who had worked in the campaign that made George Bush Sr. president, wrote a paper about president's children for George W. Bush. What Weed found disturbed him as well as the younger Bush. The children of America's presidents have a terrible record of failure and premature death. That's the subject of Doug Weed's commentary this week. He's the author of All the President's Children, Triumph and Tragedy in the Lives of the First Families.
It began really in 1988. I was working for the George Herbert Walker Bush presidential campaign, but my immediate boss was George W. Bush, 43rd president of the United States. The election was over. His father had won, and we were talking about who goes to the White House and who goes to the inaugural committee and who goes into transition. And George W. sighed real big and said, "What's going to happen to me?" I was rather startled. We hadn't been thinking about him or focusing on him, any of us in the campaign. I said, "You want me to do a memo on what happens to presidential children?" He said, "Sure." So I organized my staff. We spent 30 days. We knocked out a 44-page memo. And the results were very startling even then. 15 years later, here's the book. One of the things I noticed is that while in most families the firstborn and a son or daughter named after a parent is empowered, among presidential children it's like a curse. John Adams II dies an alcoholic at the age of 31, William Henry Harrison Jr. at 35, Andrew Johnson Jr. at 26, and they die from accidents. There's apparently some unconscious self-hatred or self-destruction. Andrew Jackson dies after a hunting accident. Calvin Coolidge Jr. dies at the age of 16 after an accident on the White House tennis courts. 10 years after I submitted this report to George W. Bush, who was named after his dad, John F. Kennedy Jr. disappeared over the Atlantic, and I had chills go down my spine as I was listening to the reports coming in. All of us seek the approval of the father figure in our life through either mimicry or completion. Completion is when we do what our father didn't do. And I found among firstborn sons and daughters a tendency towards completion. William Henry Harrison had wanted to be a doctor. His son became a doctor. Teddy Roosevelt's greatest disappointment was not winning the Medal of Honor after his charge up Kettle Hill in San Juan. His son, Teddy Roosevelt Jr., went out and won every medal available to U.S. ground forces, including the Medal of Honor. John F. Kennedy had planned on being a publisher, a journalist, and a publisher. His son, John F. Kennedy Jr., became a publisher. And there was a lot of controversy during this Iraqi war over the fact that the father had not finished Saddam Hussein and the son was trying very much to do so. It is an interesting phenomena. It's true in all of our lives, but it's especially fascinating, troubling, and encouraging to see it on the public stage like this when we know the father and we know the son. History is filled with the stories of a son picking up the sword that the father left on the battlefield. It's just that today's swords are tipped with nuclear weapons, and it's a whole different time.
You've been listening to Doug Weed, and that brings us to the end of another week of Talking History. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. William L. Andrews' segment on Frederick Douglass was a production of Teacher as Historian, broadcast on WNYE-FM in New York City. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.